women are told that you have to be attractive to succeed. Menstruation is almost like an original sin. Like, sex is human nature.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the O Collective Just Like You podcast.
We're Eden, Diana, Wingsy, and Simona, and we're all about female intimate wellness and pleasure.
As modern third culture kids, we thought it can be helpful to share our guests and our own experiences around sex and intimacy for anyone out there to navigate their way through life.
Today, our guest is Ying. Ying is a rebel who has followed many different paths. She's a high school dropout who went to finish a PhD in psychology at Stanford. She's probably the best pole dancer who used to be a McKinsey consultant.
And she has made a bold career decision when she quit her well-paid Nike executive job to open a sex shop in China, where sex is heavily censored.
She's now an entrepreneur on her second startup attempt, BPG, which is focusing on promoting menstrual health.
Hi!
Hello, hi girls. So nice to see you.
Nice to see you too. Thank you for joining the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, to get the podcast started, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? Where did you grow up and what are your roots?
I'm definitely a third culture kid. So I have, I was born in Shanghai. I moved to Hong Kong, grew up in Hong Kong. Then went to Canada for high school, went to the US for college and grad school, and then moved to Japan for my job before moving back to Shanghai. So I've basically lived all over the world, doing all sorts of different things. So it's kind of funny when people ask me roots. So this is the kind of question that I'm like, I don't know. Like, if you ask me, you know, where's your hometown, where you're from, that's always a question that gets me, just like it gets a lot of third culture kids, I think. You're like, well, okay, define, you know, hometown. Is it emotional attachment or where you grew up? Well, what does it really mean? So that's how I feel. I'm like, I don't know. I grew up all over the place. That's what I usually tell people.
We all grew up somewhere else than where our parents grew up, and we're all working somewhere else than where we grew up. Yeah. Maybe as a little icebreaker for us and for the audience, can you tell us when you masturbated for the first time?
This is a fun question because I don't actually remember like the first time I masturbated. I think I was actually pretty old by then. That's in my 20s. But what I remember more distinctly, right, or what's more of a strong memory for me is the first time I actually had orgasm while masturbating, because that was a very different experience. And that came very late, right? Like in my late 20s. And I think that's something that's striking, but also very common for women, which is that they could go through a long period of their sex life and adult life and masturbating and trying different things and still not knowing what is orgasm really. And so, yeah, like research shows that a lot of women don't actually orgasm for the first time until their late 20s or 30s. And that was exactly my experience. Just one day being at home and feeling like, oh, you know, I'm close to something. And, you know, then not giving up and keep trying until I finally get there. And it was actually an interesting moment because you hear so much about orgasm and you're like, oh, you know, what is it really like? It's going to be awesome. And that moment, it was awesome, but also a little bit underwhelming, right? It's not like this explosive moment, like, you know, where you're just having this out of world experience, but also you're just so glad that you finally know what it is. And it's a very warm sensation rather than just like super physical experience, I would say. Something kind of spiritual.
It's great that you shared that, Ying. So we've heard that quite often actually from women that tell us, hey, I'm not able to get an orgasm and I don't know what I'm doing wrong or how to improve. But I do feel like we often underestimate how we should enjoy the journey towards the orgasm more instead of only focusing on having the orgasm. Is sometimes you put a lot of pressure on trying to get that orgasm that you sometimes a little bit forget about how to enjoy it before you go to the orgasm. So I really love that you shared this about your experience.
I totally agree, because I think that pressure, right, is sometimes so strong that you definitely actually it messes up the sensation for you, right? And we see that, like, it prevents people from actually having orgasm, both during partner sex and also during, like, masturbation. So I think you're definitely right. Like, just enjoy it, right, and let it go, and not necessarily rush it, but just cherish whatever you're feeling right now and explore.
Ying, I have a question. So what are some keywords you would use to express what orgasm felt like for you?
This is kind of a fun, not fun, but weird word, but it's almost like the keyword that I think of is relief, right? It's just like there's a lot of pent up tension, pressure that just goes away, and you're like, ah.
That kind of reminds me of, like, you know, when you do yoga, and then when you're in, like, this, I think it's called a crow pose, not a crow pose. You're doing this pose where you're completely entangled, your legs and your arms, and then you have to squeeze yourself as tight as possible and be centered and not fall. And then once you release, the yoga teacher always says, oh, once you release, you'll feel that relief, and your blood will then flow throughout your whole body. It kind of sounds like similar to, like, doing yoga as well.
There's something building up, right? And, you know, emotionally, and, like, you're really focusing on it. Or even in real life, when you feel like you have a lot of pressure, you know, and then you go into that mode where you focus on yourself and your body, and relief is when you can just let go and just, like, then relax and enjoy the moment.
So you would almost say that it's just another form of yoga or meditation, right? It's all for relief and relaxation and to calm the mind to a certain extent. So kind of serves the same purpose, all of it.
Yeah.
I would like to ask you, Ying, like, the four of us here, the three of us are ex-Nike girls. Me, Simona, you included. Winksy's still at Nike, and so is our other partner. But, you know, you having had a career at Nike and also worked at McKinsey as a consultant, what was the learning curve like for you to open a sex shop? And did you see a business opportunity to begin with, or was it more like a passion project?
It was definitely a little bit more of a passion project for me. I had this idea of a sex shop back when I was in grad school, and I was in the Bay Area at the time, in San Francisco Bay Area, and the culture there is very open-minded, right? It's sexually speaking, it's, like, very liberated, and they had the women-owned sex shop called Good Vibes, and that was a little bit eye-opening for me, and I thought, you know, one day I should go back to China, and this is something that would be fun to explore in China, because Chinese women really need it. You know, years later, I was at Nike and in my late 30s. So I was thinking to myself, what do I really want to do in my career? Do I want to keep climbing the corporate ladder, or do I want to do something that is maybe, like, a little bit more personally meaningful to me? And I thought, okay, so I don't have, you know, burdens of tuition or kids. So why don't I just, like, take the plunge and try something that's challenging and interesting to me? And so I thought of this, I picked up this sex shop idea again, because I really thought that, again, Chinese women can really use a concept like that. I wasn't really sure about the business opportunity. I mean, industry-wise, it's a big opportunity, but at the same time, I really wasn't sure how it was going to go in a culture where that's still very much taboo.
What was mainly the reason that you closed?
Yeah, so that's, I guess that also gets back to the question of a learning curve too, right? I think running like a physical store and your own venture starting from zero, right? Like ground zero is really different from having a corporate job. So when you have to build things, you know, from ground up, there are a lot of like minute details and things that you never have to pay attention to when you are in a management position or, you know, working on, you know, very high level projects. So it was just like a lot of different challenges that I never faced before, like, you know, recruitment, finding people to work at the shop, like, you know, dealing with the government to find to get your all your permits or paperwork and things like that, or finding your suppliers and negotiating terms, just all these like nitty gritty details. It's very different. So you might think that, hey, you know, I've worked at big companies at Nike, you know, I'm well experienced. But when you tried your own business, just starting from one shop, it's not very applicable, I would say, the skills that you've picked up. So you start from, you start afresh, basically.
We are very lucky that we're a team of four, and then we're like, okay, can you do this? And can you pick up this? And can you pick up that? But you are doing this by yourself, right?
Yeah, I think that was what made it very hard, was not having a team, right? So I do think that teamwork is just like super, super important. That might be part of the reason why we decided to close. It was a multitude of reasons. It was just getting a little bit hard to run that sex shop without a team, number one. Number two, the COVID made it hard to really operate a physical store, like a brick and mortar location, because rent was expensive, operations expensive, and there wasn't as much traffic. And then it's also just the business landscape. Like, I think it's hard to make it in China when you are doing brick and mortar. It just doesn't work. So I think if I were to succeed in that industry, like, I would have to change my business model around. I still believe in a mission to help women get better sexual health, but a sex shop was probably not the right level to do that. So you know, a combination of these factors made me decide to change direction and close B-Spot.
You started in 2017, you closed down in 2020. Did you see interest growing for sex toys and sex and sexual wellness in general?
One of the challenges I kept on having was how to advertise our store. It was hard. We tried a lot of different platforms to advertise, but it's a taboo topic. You have a lot of limitations. So you can't really openly advertise, number one. Number two, like, there are a lot of things that you can't talk about, right? Like, you can't even use keywords like sexy, or, for example, on TikTok, right? Like, we try to bring up like certain topics, be a little bit sexy, but, you know, you keep on hitting these issues. So it's actually really hard for us to bring the level of traffic up. We had a lot of repeat customers. We had people who would come back, but, you know, that would just take too long for us to really build enough traffic. Even though we had a very good reputation, and people who had been to our store loved our store. In terms of the type of people who we saw, that was the cool thing about Shanghai, right? Like, Shanghai is a very diverse city with a lot of people who are a lot more open-minded. We saw a lot of people who came actually from all sorts of backgrounds. We had people who, you know, who were maybe I would call more advanced players, you know, like BDSM players from both overseas and also in China come. We also had people who were, and this is a big part of our clientele, which were more white collar workers, right? Like just highly educated women who were more independent minded and more liberal, and they agreed with the importance of sexual health and sexual health wellness. And these were people who came to the store.
What was the best-selling product for you?
I do think that vibrators were our best sellers, and usually like vibrators within a certain range, right? Like around 500 kwai. That's very different from, you know, the best sellers online.
What is the strangest encounter that you had?
There's some like weird couples, like, you know, older men and younger women sort of, and they come in to ask for performance enhancing products. We don't sell those, right? And they would be like, you know, what kind of sex shop wouldn't carry drugs like that? It was really nice to be there and meet this full range of people. It's a more intimate place, right? You find out about people in a way that you don't find out about them.
I have to say, I just started because I wanted to see how it is to work in a sex shop and also to be in a sex environment. So I am actually working at a sex shop right now, like one day a week, to get to know how it is. I live in Amsterdam, so it's very easy. Like when you go into the red light district, there's so many shops around you. And I walked by one time and I saw that they were looking for people. And I thought, why not? I might just like spend a couple of hours in a sex shop and to get a real understanding of it, since we are running our own sex toy brand as well. And then I had my first day last week, but it's very surprising to me that there's such a full range of different people, and also people that you, because I think there's, people have this conception about people that go to a sex shop, that visit a sex shop, like, oh, it's dirty maybe, and it needs to be hidden. But all the people that came in are super normal. The same type of girls that will go to, I'm just saying, Monkey or H&M to buy new clothes, but also couples that you maybe see in a supermarket. It's, I think it's overly exaggerated of what people think of the person that goes to a sex shop, because I stood there for 6 hours and I was really amazed by just how normal the audience was. And I think that's kind of good to see, or liberating to see, yeah. to know that people actually, it's not one type of person that goes to a sex shop. It can be everybody. Everybody who is who is a little bit interested in their own sexual health.
Yeah, just to back up your point, I do think that people are just like very nice people who come to sex shops, right? Like, for example, at V-Spot, we've never had any shoplifting incidents. Like, you know, we never had any merchandise missing. We never have to worry about people just like taking our stuff, right? It just never happened.
Isn't that just China as well? Aren't they very strict about shoplifting?
That's possibly, like, but I was still amazed, you know, like that it doesn't happen. I think what's interesting about me being in the sex toy industry is that once I started telling people start this sex shop, V-Spot, and tell people about it, I realized that there are people all around me who are actually in the industry. So somehow it's just people never talk about it, right? Like, but once you tell them, they'll tell you stuff like, oh, you know, my cousin is in the porn industry, or they'll tell you, oh, my brother-in-law works for blah, 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 you know, one of the largest wholesalers in the US. You people pop up, right? And you find out that they're all around you, but it's just that they never want to talk about it. But it is a big part of our lives. It is a huge industry. And that's when you find out about them. When they know that you're an industry and they feel comfortable talking to you about it.
I feel in China, they're less open to talk about sex or the sexual experiences. Did you experience the same?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, China, like the average couple is definitely, you know, more reluctant to talk about it. But we also had a lot of social events at V-Spot. For example, we had a lot of BDSM members come to our store, right? Like the BDSM community would have parties at our store, and you would see like very cool couples, right? Like by Chinese standards, they're just like really out there, right? For example, we have one customer who's actually a straight man, but he lost a bet and therefore he had breast implants, right? So he's just like dude with like huge, beautiful breasts. And we had...
He lost a bet and then he got breast implants? What? It's like, I dare you to chuck a glass of beer, and if you cannot chuck it, you need to get breast implants? That type of dare?
That's so extreme.
Yes.
I think it was a big bet. But yeah, like you see, and then you're like, you know, China is not all boring like that. You know, there are a lot of cool people in costumes and all sorts of puppy play or whatever play, like all the BDSM fetishes or whatever, they are there in China. You just don't see them.
That's true.
It's human nature, right? Like sex is human nature, right? Like you can hide it, but you can't stamp it out, right? So people are there. You just don't hear them. That's all.
Hey Ying, I had a question actually about when you first went down the route of opening your own sex shops and promoting pleasure. How was the response of your parents and your friends around you and the people around you?
They were surprisingly supportive. So I have to say that my mom was had always been very supportive. Like when I actually, so I was telling you that I got the idea of a sex shop back in grad school, right? Like I actually remember her visiting me in the Bay Area, and I took her to Good Vibes and I showed her, and she had a giggle out of it, right? She thought it was so funny. And I said, yeah, you know, like Chinese women should be able to have a store, like go into a store like this as well. And she agreed. And she said, yeah. She said, Chinese women of my generation never knew what orgasm was about. Like we just weren't educated. So, she bought a vibrator, which she never used. She put it, you know, on a bookshelf. I think it was just like a token of support for Good Vibes. She never bought any for me, by the way. But they were supportive, right? And they understood my reason to do this. And so, again, like there are a lot of things that's on surface, right? Like on surface, you see this Chinese culture where, you know, things are taboo and, you know, like regular people don't talk about it. But then you dig deeper and you peel away the onion, and there's this diversity and there are people who actually understand you. So it's been a very cool experience to have them support me like that.
Hey, like, can you tell us a little bit about Be Peachy?
Yeah, Be Peachy is, you know, the new venture that I'm doing. So we actually, we're kind of like a combination of product and service. So we will be launching our product soon in December, I hope. And that is menstrual underwear. So it's basically the underwear that can replace menstrual products like tampons and pads. So that's the product that we'll be selling. But also we will be having a mini program, which is sort of a menstrual helper. So it would include things like menstrual predictions, like basically like period tracker plus more monitoring functions.
So what is one of the biggest misconceptions in I think in Chinese culture when it comes to menstrual health? Like for me, I have a lot of I came from Europe from Amsterdam to Shanghai, and then all the things that I heard about menstrual health and how you take care of it and the menstrual cycle are so different.
The biggest thing is that menstruation is almost like an original sin in China, right? It's like the original sin of women. It's dirty, it's shameful. It kind of like marks you, right? Like there's a lot of prejudice against women and menstruation. So there are a lot of things that Chinese women are not supposed to do when they're on their period. They are not supposed to eat anything cold. They're not supposed to go upside down. They're not supposed to exercise. So yeah, it's like, it's just, it marks you as something that's, I don't know, like sub woman almost. It's also just unlucky. It's unclean, right? So like, it's the kind of thing that you're supposed to throw at ghosts to chase them away because it's so dirty. Menstruation is just, it's a whole bucket of bad things that Chinese women have to contend with, right? Like when you're born with this uncleanliness, then what do you do with it?
So with all of your experience right now, both in the sexual wellness industry and now also with your upcoming startup, is there one piece of advice that you would give all girls or women out there to know and never forget?
I don't know if it's especially in China, but women are so chased by this narrative that you have to be attractive. In China, though, I think women are told that you have to be attractive to succeed, but at the same time, nobody tells you that you're attractive. Like there's just a lot of, I wouldn't say bullying, but for example, my family would always just give me negative comments about my appearance or body, right? Like they don't think they would, it's not that they want to disparage you, right? They just think they're being real, right? They're not giving you false hubris, right? So they'd be like, oh, you know, your butt looks too big in those jeans, or like, don't wear that. But they don't ever give you like positive feedback. So, you know, a lot of women, I feel like they grow up having this like sense of hopelessness, right? Like, oh, there's this like superstar, but I'm never beautiful enough. My body is never in the right shape. You know, so they constantly have to go on diets or exercise programs or skincare routines or whatever to be better, to be more attractive. It's a lot of pressure, especially for younger women. What I want to say to these women and 14-year-old me, because that was definitely me, just, you know, don't be so anxious, because looks, attractiveness, it's not really defined by your appearance and your body shape. You will be okay. You know, you will find a way to express your attractiveness, and it's not going to define your success or happiness.
It's a big part of Chinese culture, I think, to be so honest about somebody's and how you look like. In the West, we're a little bit more censored when it comes to giving your opinion on how somebody looks like. They in the West, I feel they would rather compliment you, and if there's something that they want to remark about you, they hold it for themselves, whereas in Asia, they're very honest about it. And I feel that can, it's not always for the best of the receiver of that remark. I've definitely also seen that on my end. Like when I was younger, as a European kid coming to China every year, you're already bigger than most of the Chinese girls. I don't know what's in the food here, but you're always bigger. It doesn't matter. And then here, they like it when you're 10, you know? So I came as a big 10 Chinese girl to my parents' village, and then just the entire village just saying like, oh my god, you're so ugly, you're so big, you need to be wider, you need to be skinnier, this is not how a Chinese girl should look like. So I've definitely felt that part, and I think it's just no out of value actually for anybody to hear these type of comments. There is, even though the person who's giving that remark, they mean it in the best way and they don't mean anything bad, there's no out of value. It just messes with
there's
your
no
mind.
Out of value And it's false, right? Like, it's not going to actually, yeah, define your relationship attractiveness, success, or happiness, really. You could be the splitting image of Chinese standard of beauty and wouldn't mean these things anyway.
I love that advice. All right, I will wrap this up. Thank you so much, Yang, for joining our podcast. Lastly, if our listeners want to know more about Yang, where can they find you?
They can still go to VSpot account. I mean, we are still active. They can still find me there. We haven't opened the PG account yet. We will soon. But yeah, they're welcome to leave me messages there.